This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 235, was recorded on September 3rd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by FarmTogether.com, bringing farmland, a new trillion-dollar investment opportunity, within reach of all accredited investors. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman is back as this week's feature interview guest. And, of course, I'll be asking Luke the same question I've asked most of our other recent interview guests. Is the U.S. dollar having that Luke Grohman moment that he's been predicting for years? We'll also discuss the stock market, U.S. fiscal situation, gold, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will take a deep dive on the question of whether or not we're seeing a stock market top, or if this is just another buy-the-dip opportunity as stocks sell off sharply today on Thursday, the day that we're recording. We'll look at the tech stocks, and we'll also move on and take a look at term structure of both crude oil and natural gas futures.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's talk equities. The S&P 500 at the time we're recording is down 120 S&P points on what is the first major reversal day since the start of the summer. What's your take on all of this?
Reversal day, I totally agree with that. This is a reversal day by any measure, that's for sure. But I'm blown away by some of the headlines that I'm seeing online. The stock market is crashing! It's crashing! Okay, wait a minute. Let's define crashing. What the stock market has done today is it's sold off sharply all the way down to levels that have not been seen since, wait for it, a week and a half ago when they were all-time highs. And by the way, they were all-time highs hundreds of points above the previous all-time high. So, you know, there was another Zero Hedge headline today I was really surprised by. It said, the S&P 500 is inexplicably selling off. Inexplicably? I think the explanation is because it's been in a parabolic rise for several weeks with almost all green candles, and it was way overdue for some kind of technical pullback. So the real question we got to focus on, Patrick, is not what's the crash, because that's silly, but rather, are we seeing a topping process beginning? Is there reason to expect that? Or is this just a simple technical pullback and a buy-the-dip opportunity? That's going to require some more time, so let's save it for the post-game segment.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, because it looked like a week ago that the dollar was ready to start a new leg of its downtrend, but really in the last few days has worked its way back toward the 93 handle, not yet above it, but I mean, are we going to still see more weakness in the dollar? What's your take on all of this?
I think it's too early to say. What we're seeing so far is a textbook bounce off a very oversold condition, and you'd expect a bounce here. The question is that a dead cat bounce, or is there actually a bottom being put in here? I'm not sure yet. I think we need to wait and see what happens. Certainly, though, Luke Grohman is the man who's been calling for years now for a very, very significant secular decline in the U.S. dollar. Has one started? Is that what this is about, or is that still over the horizon? Let's ask Luke in the feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because for pretty much the entire month of August, we were within a $2 range, a 5% range on crude oil. And suddenly, in the last few days, we finally seen some volatility. It broke to the downside, but is this the start of a big sell-off in your mind?
Well, Patrick, I want to say, boy, okay, finally, let's look at the chart after more than two solid months of consolidation. We're finally seeing clear signs of that move to the downside that I've been predicting for, what, 3 months or something now? Okay, but wait a minute. Regular listeners know, how many times in the last 2 months have I said, okay, folks, it looks like we're finally seeing the beginning of that move to the downside, and it turns out that we put in a very buyable bottom, And that was it. So it does look, again, on the chart to me, it looks like, hey, this is maybe looking pretty serious here. We are, from a seasonality standpoint, we're past August, we're past summer driving season. This is usually when the oil market tends, on a seasonality basis, to top and to start to move down. And there's a lot of concern in the marketplace now about refinery runs last week in the EIA data report, and also just in general concerns about weakening demand in the face of the coronavirus crisis clearly not being over as people had thought. So seems like lots of reason to think the sell-off is upon us. But frankly, Patrick, as much as the last couple of days of tape action look like it's all to the downside, this market bottomed at 7:30 this morning before the U.S. session even opened, and it's been up all day. Now, we haven't gotten back quite, I would say, $42, which is the 34-day continuation chart moving average. I'd say that if we had seen a close above that figure, above $42, today I would have said, okay, this was a bear trap. We're going to see a recovery here. Where we stand right now is we're recording just after the pit close on Thursday afternoon at 41 spot 41. We're right on the 55-day moving average. I could see this going either way. Maybe this is just a dead cat bounce and there's still lower numbers to come. Maybe we are actually seeing that recovery. Normally, I'd say, as I read this chart, looks to me like there's more downside to come. But boy, how many times have I said that in the last couple of months and been proven wrong? So maybe this will be just another buyable dip. We'll see what happens. But I think this one, just from a seasonality perspective, maybe has more room to go to the downside. Let's move on to inventory. Wow, huge numbers this week. And it wasn't bearish data. It was actually what should have been bullish data. Crude oil drawing down 9.4 million barrels from officially designated commercial storage and another 1.3 million barrels from the government's Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But remember, that's been leased out for commercial storage. So I think that that whole number of more than 10 million barrels, 10.7 it works out to, was probably effectively the commercial drawdown. That should be a very bullish indication. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 110,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 4.3 million barrels, distillates drawing down 1.7 million barrels. So with the small exception of a de minimis build in Cushing, Oklahoma, it was drawdowns across the board. That would normally be very bullish news. But frankly, it wasn't enough to overcome selling that had already begun. A lot of analysts think that it was the reports of lower refinery runs indicating weakening demand, as well as the outlook around the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. U.S. production was down dramatically to 9.7 million barrels. That's more than a million barrels down from last week. Sounds like, oh my gosh, boy, it must be that Art Berman is being proven right in spades. Well, wait a minute, folks. This was numbers that were impaired by a huge, massive storm in the Gulf of Mexico, temporarily shutting in almost all Gulf of Mexico production. So it comes as no surprise that we had a massive temporary shortfall of U.S. production. I expect that number to bounce back up as that production comes back online. Storm's over now. Tape action wasn't nearly enough to offset selling that was already in motion before the data came out, and we continued to sell off for the rest of the day. $3 move down before it was all said and done as of 7:30 this morning from where we started a couple of days ago. But, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what the next couple of days bring, because this bounce we saw today was pretty darn formidable.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold. So during the early part of the summer, we saw that huge surge almost to 2100 on the upside of gold. And since then, for last month, we've just been consolidating, giving a chunk of it back. And we saw a false rally earlier this week, and it looks like gold is still very weak. I mean, do you think there's still more to the downside correction, or is this almost over?
It's not clear to me whether this correction has farther to go to the downside. Frankly, I hope it does. I think it would be good to clean out the system, so to speak, and pave the way for a healthier bull market going forward. One thing I feel very confident of is there's no doubt that the long-term picture here is governments are going to continue to debase fiat currency. It's a bull market for gold, and I think it's going to stay a bull market for gold. But hey, we're way overdue for a serious technical correction. I know I've been saying that for months and months and it hasn't happened. Is it finally starting, or is this just a temporary little blip and time to buy right now? Well, it's hard to say. We'll see what happens. I'll certainly be asking Luke Grohman, because he's been bullish gold for years and years.
All right, Eric, let's just touch on the 10-year Treasury yield, because it really looked like yields were breaking out. I mean, we were almost over 75 basis points late last week. And since then, it's been giving it all back. We're almost back down to 60 basis points. What's next for Treasury yields from here?
Patrick, as our regular listeners know, I really don't have any opinion short-term what's going on here, but I think that the uncertainty you're seeing in the market is probably because a lot of other people are wrestling with the same question that I'm wrestling with, which is, my view is that the 35-year bond bull market is going to end with a shift to secular inflation sometime between tomorrow morning and 3 years from now. Okay, is it starting now, or is it not time yet? Well, my focus going forward is going to be to try to refine that time frame. But my basic view is we're going to see an end to this 35-year bond bull market. We'll probably move into at least a significant consolidation period, and then eventually a bond bear market. But does that start now, or does it start next year, or does it start the year after that? I'm going to continue asking our feature interview guests. My inclination is it's not quite time yet. So I think there may still be more downside room in yields before eventually we see a secular reversal.
Well, thanks, Eric. So this week's feature interview guest is Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman. Now, Eric, why did we invite Luke back on the show this week?
Well, our regular listeners know the question that I've been asking all of our feature interview guests is, hey, is the U.S. dollar having that Luke Grohman moment that Luke's been predicting for years? And we've gotten quite a few different reactions to that. Everybody is familiar with Luke's views. Is he going to be proven right, or is he still early? We've got lots of different views. I thought it was well past time to ask the man himself. Does Luke think this is the moment where he begins to be proven right? Or is this just one step along the way? I think you're going to find Luke's answers very interesting. Listeners, we know many of you agree with us that we're the best financial podcast on the internet, because that's what iTunes and Apple Podcasts used to say about us. Unfortunately, we haven't been reminding you to do those ratings and reviews, which keep us in our number one slot, which we really feel like we deserve. And by the way, that's what helps us get the very best feature guests to come on the program. So your ratings and reviews really do help us to get better feature interviews for your future listening pleasure. Writing a five-star review for Macro Voices is simple. The instructions, step-by-step, are in your research roundup email. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Luke Grohman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman. Luke, as our regular listeners know, I've been asking all of our featured guests the same question recently, which is, boy, weakness in the U.S. dollar relative to other currencies caught some of us off guard. You're the guy who has been saying for years that the U.S. dollar was headed for not just a little move down, but eventually a secular decline, a loss of reserve currency status, a sunsetting, if you will, of the dollar's hegemony over the global financial system. And what I've been asking all of our other guests is, okay, with this weakness in the dollar, is this just a little move down, or are we seeing the beginning of that Luke Groman moment where you're proven right? And we've had a number of different views. It's an interesting coincidence that on Tuesday morning, as we're recording this interview, the dollar index broke at least intraday well below 92 for the first time in, what, more than a year. So I want to get your take from the man directly. Do you think that this is the beginning of the big move that you've expected for quite a while, or is this really not deterministic yet to make that conclusion?
Well, I think the short version is it's too early to be deterministic. I think really when you look at what we've been saying, it's been that the not necessarily that the dollar will lose reserve status, but that the dollar's reserve status as structured since 1971 will end. And not only will it end, but it's in process of ending, because historically that system was, we export dollars and those dollars are recycled back into treasuries, and basically a system where global central banks sterilize U.S. dollar outflows by buying treasuries. And so when you go back to, you know, 1971 to 1985, foreign central banks sterilized about 20% of U.S. deficits. And then from 1985 to 2002, global central banks sterilized, call it 25, 30% of U.S. deficits. And when I say that, I mean in aggregate. In other words, for every dollar, every dollar that the U.S. debt increased, you know, if I had 30 cents of that dollar ended up on foreign central bank balance sheets. And so basically what this amounted to is that treasuries were the primary reserve asset of the world. The U.S. government was basically emitting gold, or what used to be gold. And so treasuries were basically the primary reserve asset. From 2002 to 2014, foreign central banks sterilized 50+ percent, 53%, I believe, of U.S. aggregate debt increases. And from 2014 until today, that number is -4%, which means the way the U.S. dollar's reserve status worked for 50 years almost already stopped. And what they've done instead is reserve gold. And you've seen, even as they've stopped buying treasuries, they, foreign central banks, have stopped buying treasuries. They've been buying gold. So my views has been, continues to be, that the structure of the dollar's reserve status is already 6 to 7 years into changing. I think the pace of that is accelerating. When you then look at this particular move in the dollar relative to that longer term view, I have sort of two thoughts. The first is, given the way the world, that system worked, the U.S. had to, by definition, run the biggest deficits in the world to supply the dollars to the rest of the world. So understanding that, we know that whenever this system starts to break down, the end game is that the U.S. has to print the mostest. And it's not even close, because basically as that system breaks down, every nation has to finance their own deficits. And the only nation used to running really big deficits by virtue of the way the old system worked is the U.S. So we've always known that the U.S. would have to print the mostest. The question has always been, and where the vigorous debate between myself and others that have been on the show is do they have to print the fastest? And that, I think, ties partly into what we've seen in this latest dollar move down, which is we've all known the end game, which is the U.S. has to print the mostest. But the U.S. was not printing the fastest over the last couple of years until COVID. And now when you look at what has happened since COVID, the U.S. has been printing the fastest and the mostest, and the dollar's responded. The other thing I think within this particular dollar move that is noteworthy, that most commentators that I have seen on the topic are not talking about, but which I think is a monumental move, and which a number of other financials analysts that I've talked to think is a monumental move, is what the Fed did back in April when they exempted treasuries from the supplementary leverage ratio calculations for the U.S. banking system. And so basically what that means is that the banks can buy effectively an infinite amount of treasury bonds, and it doesn't count against their capital ratios, which was the case under Basel III up until that point. And so it was, in a way of doing infinite QE through the U.S. banking system, without the Fed having to call it QE with the wave of a regulatory wand. And what's interesting is since the day that the Fed exempted treasuries from the SLR, the US dollar, the trade weighted dollar index is down, I think in 5 months as of today, 7%. So you're talking about almost a 15% annualized rate of decline in the dollar, maybe a little bit more. You've seen gold go up about 20 or 25%, gold miners up a lot more than that. So there's been, I think to summarize the answer is we've been in this change of the dollar reserve status system. I think the dollar is going to stay the reserve currency. I think the structure of that reserve currency has been changing. And I think if you look within that, then in terms of the tactical side of this dollar move down, the U.S. is printing both the fastest and the mostest, whereas before we just knew they were eventually going to have to print the mostest. And then this SLR rule change that continues to not get enough airplay, in my view, I think is a really important thing in terms of also helping to explain this tactical move down in the dollar.
Luke, I've been transfixed for the last couple of minutes with one particular snippet of what you just said. You mentioned that you have said in the past that the U.S. in the endgame will be forced to print the mostest. I'm going to ask you to just briefly give our listeners a refresher on that, because some of our newer listeners may not remember your descriptions of that previously. But particularly what really caught my ear was you said, and we're nowhere close to that yet. So it sounds like even in the face of, you know, the heights of the COVID crisis with trillions of dollars a week in new central bank accommodation, you don't think that even gets to the printing the mostest that you define as a necessary part of the U.S. dollar endgame. So how big is the mostest? But let's start with why the U.S. will eventually have to print the mostest.
Well, so why the U.S. will eventually have to print the mostest is if you just look at a global ranking of current account deficits by nation. And I've put it on Twitter before, I can put it up there again. But if you look at the chart, you end up with the current account surplus nations and regions over on the left. And the by far the biggest current account surplus region actually is the European Union. Then you're followed by China and Japan. From there, things start to sort of get very plus minus, right? A little bit of a surplus, and you have a whole probably 10 or 15, 20 nations that are a little bit of surplus. Then you get into a bunch of nations that are basically flat. Then you get into a bunch of nations that are tiny deficits. And then you get into two big deficit, current account deficit nations. The one is the UK, and as big as they are dwarfed by current account deficit nation number two, which is the United States of America. And this isn't because the US is bad or because we're particularly profligate or any more than any other nation. It's just a vestige of the way the post-1971 dollar system worked, which was we ran these massive current account deficits and we ran capital account surpluses. And in other words, we emitted dollars. We became the Saudi Arabia of money. Saudi Arabia of money, as the Financial Times termed it in early 2019. And so we had to emit dollars, and then those dollars would be were emitted in payments. So let me back up. After 1971, we outsourced our jobs and our factories abroad, those to foreign countries. Those nations would make stuff, send it to us. We would then emit dollars to those nations in payment, and then they would recycle those dollars back into our financial markets, into our capital account. And then that capital account recycling would help provide, number one, it would finance U.S. government deficits at the treasury, buying treasury bonds, ties into that point I made earlier about the how many of our or how much of our deficits were sterilized by foreign central banks. They rolled into U.S. agency markets, providing cheap credit to the U.S. housing market. They rolled into U.S. subprime markets, basically funded consumer lending so that U.S. consumers could turn around and buy more of the goods those countries were producing. And so the producers were on the current account surplus side. The United States was down at the biggest current account deficit side. Now, all this works as long as those surpluses they're running are being recycled back into our capital account, surplus. But my first point I made was in 2014, they stopped doing that at the treasury bond level. They stopped buying treasury. So now, suddenly, our current account's deficit, which is by far the biggest in the world, and which is more than 100% made up of U.S. government deficits, not trade deficits, suddenly we've got to finance our own deficits for the first time in 50 to 70 years. And there's no one around with enough balance sheet to do that other than the Fed. And so we tried to finance it ourselves at first, and that describes what happened from 2014 through last year when you had this period of a rising dollar and you had rising LIBOR. And then last year you had Fed funds rates get squeezed over interest on excess reserves. And as the U.S. banking system got force-fed treasuries. And finally, the banking system ran out of balance sheet to buy these treasuries last September. And that was the repo rate spike. And once the repo rate spike happened, the Fed had to begin growing their balance sheet again. And at that time, we said they're probably never going to stop. And then we had COVID, and they tried to stop earlier this year. We had COVID, and that's why we have to print the mostest, is if you just look at that current account chart, we run the biggest deficits. And so if we run the biggest deficits and the people financing our deficits stop financing our deficits, which they did 6 years ago, then we have to print the mostest.
Luke, you said that even in the face of current events, the COVID crisis, trillions of dollars a week, that we're, if I remember exactly what you said, nowhere close to printing the mostest yet. So how do we quantify? What does printing the mostest look like? What amount of balance sheet expansion are we really considering there?
Well, I would say, when I say no one's close to having to print as much as we are, in the end game, no one has to print as much as we do because of what I just described. Now, when we look at what the U.S. did at the height of COVID in April, I think the number was a $35 trillion annual rate that the Fed's balance sheet was expanding at. I think if I remember right, and you smooth it out over April and May, I think the number was a $20 trillion annual rate. So that's over 2 months growing the Fed balance sheet at a 100%, nearly 100% of U.S. GDP rate. It's pretty meaningful. How much will we eventually have to do, I think, is dependent on a couple of factors. I think it's dependent on, the biggest one is U.S. nominal GDP growth. And part of that also depends on what happens to the dollar. So the problem ultimately, as Jeff Snyder eloquently lays out, is you've got this euro-dollar system with all these dollar loans, and the Fed can't really address the problem. Not directly, at least, as things are structured now. And he highlights that, hey, this is why it's going to be, things are going to be deflationary, that's why the dollar should rise, etc. My view has long been that, A, Jeff is right, that will cause a big problem. But that where I and Jeff differ is when push comes to shove, and push will eventually come to shove, the Fed will just buy the whole euro, they'll bail out the whole euro dollar market. They'll have to, they won't have a choice. And to me, one of the big aha moments of this year was a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, if I would have said, Luke, there's no way the Fed's going to grow their balance sheet enough to bail out the entire euro dollar market. It's estimated at anywhere from $60 to $100 trillion. There's no way they'll do that. And I would have said, yeah, they will, or the system will collapse. And I think one of the big aha moments of this year was they grew the balance sheet at a $35 trillion annual rate for a month and a $20 trillion annual rate for 2 months. And so I think it was very, when you say how much will they have to do, I think they've shown us they'll do whatever it takes. And the question then is what will it take? And that, like I said, is dependent on what's the economy doing. If we don't get a recovery, then basically, the Fed's balance sheet over time is going to have to move toward fully reserving the entire global euro dollar system. So whatever that number is in your mind, that's the price target for the Fed's balance sheet. Now, if the U.S. economy is able to begin growing nominally again, whether that is in real terms or that is in inflation-adjusted terms where the dollar weakens meaningfully and inflation really picks up and the Fed caps yields, then the price target for the Fed's balance sheet at the end game is probably something meaningfully south of the total euro dollar market needing to be bailed out. If the U.S. is able to post real growth, significant real growth, or a massive acceleration in productivity, we come up with some new nuclear fusion, portable nuclear fusion energy source, and all of a sudden the U.S. economy just broadly accelerates massively, productivity growth massively accelerates, our entitlements are easily affordable, then the price target for the Fed's balance sheet comes down even further. So really, where do we go when we say how much is the most as if the Fed has to print? Depends on the inputs of, okay, what's the global economy doing? What's nominal GDP growth doing in the United States? What's productivity doing? What's the dollar doing? As it sits now on all those fronts, I would take the over on most price targets for where the Fed's balance sheet's eventually going over the next couple of years.
Luke, unfortunately, Professor Stephanie Kelton has so far not responded to our invitations for an interview on Macro Voices. But if I could guess what she, as essentially the poster woman of modern monetary theory, might say if she were in this conversation, it would be, Luke, you're missing the point. What you're calling the end game is not an end game. It's a long overdue social justice event where we finally figure out that what you're calling printing the mostest is the key to delivering social equalities and a better standard of living for the entire country. And we have been suffering from decades of misplaced policies, and what we need to do in order to get to where we should have been decades ago is to continue to expand balance sheets and do what you're calling printing the mostest. And the argument that she's been making is, you know, obviously you have to worry about that leading to inflation. There are ways to contain inflation, such as raising taxes, that the MMT crowd tends to favor as a technique of controlling inflation. And there are ways to make this printing the mostest event not some dreaded endgame, but maybe the beginning or a new beginning. How would you respond to those arguments?
I, by and large, would agree with a lot of what she says. I don't think it's necessarily a dreaded endgame either. I think it's a dreaded endgame if you're long a lot of dollars. I think it's a dreaded endgame if you've got too much of your net worth in treasury bonds yielding 65 basis points for 10 years, or JGBs yielding less than that, or boots yielding less than that. Yeah, that's pretty dreaded for those people. But I think bigger picture, I think that's where this is going. And I would one up it, or I would layer onto it, away from what Professor Stephanie Kelton says. I would direct listeners back to this BlackRock Institute white paper that we highlighted to our clients last August and have been continually highlighting ever since. And this was written by former Fed Vice Chair Stan Fisher, who Harold Malmgren called the ultimate behind the scenes actor. One of our best relationships on Wall Street has long called Fisher the godfather of central bankers. It was also co-authored by Swiss National Bank President, former Swiss National Bank President Philip Hildebrand, and former Bank of Canada Governor Jean Boivin. And the punchline of this report is this, is that they said in the next downturn, in the next crisis, we are going to go direct. We are going to do our version of MMT. And then we're going to also expand the balance sheet. We're going to do direct monetary financing of deficits, MMT. And then we're going to cap yields to offset any rise in interest rates that would hurt the stimulus or that would hurt the stimulative effects of direct monetary financing. And so that's, to me, when I see what Kelton has written and what she would say, which I think I agree with your assessment of what she would say, and I agree with her assessment. And then I layer on what Fisher, the godfather of central bankers, is saying. I think that's where this movie is going. And in the aftermath of COVID, we're seeing signs that that is rapidly being put in place. And that, to me, is, like I said, it represents a significant change to the structure of the dollar's reserve status. And I think it would be probably a really good thing. I mean, the system we have now has people rioting in the streets. So that's probably the biggest tell there is. We can hedonically just whatever we want. But the fact of the matter is you've got multiple American cities burning all over the country. Something's not working anymore. And so when you see this white paper saying effectively exactly what Kelton's saying, except it's coming from the godfather of central bankers and the BlackRock Investment Institute, to me, the gravitas associated with that in terms of policy circles. And then what we've seen since March I think it's already underway.
I'm going to take this opportunity to ask our listeners to help us persuade Professor Kelton to come on Macro Voices, both by encouraging that on Twitter and through other channels. Luke, I want to come back to the reactions I've gotten from our other guests to my question, you know, is this the Luke Groman moment? What Brent Johnson told us last week was, look, Luke's going to be proven right in the end for sure. The thing is, some kind of big catalyst is needed. You've either got to have a viable alternative to the dollar as reserve currency, or you've got to have, you know, a revolt where a whole bunch of countries stop doing business with the U.S. and you know, stop trading in dollars. Something, some event has to happen in order to bring about the magnitude of change that you've been forecasting. Other guests that we've had on this program have said similar things. I can remember Dr. Lacey Hunt, not on this podcast, but on an interview with Grant Williams, said, you know, watch for the emergence of a digital currency that threatens the dollar's hegemony and monopoly over the global financial system. That certainly echoes the predictions I made in my book, Beyond Blockchain, back in 2018. It seems, though, from what you said, you don't really see a need for a catalyst or an event to occur because you see the process as already in motion for several years now. Is that correct? Is it important to wait for or to watch for some big event that brings about a secular decline of the dollar? And is there any legitimacy to this argument that that's a prerequisite to your predictions becoming true?
No, I think it's, as you look, a lot of these things, they tend to happen little by little and then all at once. And so I think these guests are correct in saying, I'm looking for the all at once. What I would say is that it was an interview that was given by former CEO of Nike back in, I think, 2000. And what he said was, everybody's looking for the next Michael Jordan on the basketball court. But what they don't get is that he's walking up the golf fairway. And he was, of course, referring to Tiger Woods. And so I would equate that, the metaphor here is everybody's looking for the event in the events of, you know, 1944 or 1971, and whatever that whatever their event might be. But the events are walking up the golf fairway. They've been walking up the golf fairway. When global central banks stop buying U.S. Treasury bonds on net for the first time in 70 years, that's an event. When China, with the digital currency that they are very far along and they're testing it, rolling it out over the country, that's an event. When you see Russia, you know, stop storing, you know, the biggest energy exporter in the world, stop storing treasuries and instead reserve gold, that's an event. When you see the article we saw last week, which showed that for the first time, the majority of trade between Russia and China is not being done in dollars. It was 80 to 85% share of trade in 85. It's 45% share of trade between Russia and China. And some people would say, well, those are just two rogue nations. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I try to look at it more objectively and just say, those may be rogue nations, but they're also the world's biggest energy exporter and the world's biggest energy importer and energy consumer. And when you have the biggest exporter and importer of anything, that's called a market. And so the market is moving away from the petrodollar. That's a fact. That's just, you just describe what it is, right? So it's one of these things where people are looking for the all at once. And then I guess when you talk about events, and is it, are they looking for Michael Jordan or are they looking for Tiger Woods? We had this little thing that happened in March. It was a global pandemic. They shut down the global economy. Global GDP fell 50% in the United States in the second quarter. You know, Lacey Hunt had a great point. The net national savings is a percent of gross national income. It's negative as a result of COVID. The other two times in which that chart was negative was 2008 and 1932. Only other times in U.S. history, going back to 1905 or something. And I look back and go, okay, well, what happened in 1930? That happened in 32. What happened in 33? Oh, the dollar was devalued 75%. What happened in 2008? Oh, the Fed went from an $800 billion balance sheet to $4.5 trillion over the next several years. And so I just think that it's as I listen to these conditions that people attach to it, I tend to agree with almost all of them. I just think I'm watching the conditions as it's happening. I'm watching Tiger Woods walking up the fairway and they're looking for Michael Jordan on the basketball court, the next Michael Jordan on the basketball court. And so I really think it's more that type of dynamic. I mean, even when you look at, you know, Lacey saying, hey, the Fed can lend, but they can't spend. I agree. But the U.S. government can spend. And suddenly, if you look at the treatment of SLR, the SLR treatment of treasuries after April, boy, the frictions between Fed and Treasury lending spending start to get blurred, best case. So I think we are, you know, is there still an event to come? Probably. But I think a lot of these preconditions that people think haven't even happened yet have already happened.
Luke, you just mentioned the U.S. government's ability to spend. Let's move on to U.S. fiscal condition. You know, it's so tempting when you have a major crisis like this pandemic. People kind of glaze over and say, hey, hey, just don't question it. It's a crisis. You know, the thing is, the borrowing and spending is really accelerating. I'm not sure if I should ask when or if that eventually comes back to bite us. So what are the consequences and how do you see this situation developing from here?
Yeah, so if you go back to 2018, about this time, and I'm sure we probably talked about it at that time, Eric, but at that time we were noticing, and I'm almost positive I would have brought it up at the Macro Voices conference in Toronto 2 years ago, because we were writing a lot about it at that time for our clients. But the point is that back then we had two different, what we'll call them, investing graybeards. If I told you who they were, everyone would know who they are. And they've been at this game a very long time that are relationships of mine. And the thing they said to me is we were discussing the U.S. fiscal situation. And they said something I thought was really interesting, which was historically, fiscal problems aren't a problem until the sovereign nation in question has to print the interest on the debt. And the U.S., again, nominally, looking for the Michael Jordan on the basketball court view, is that we're still a long way from that. And what we looked at 2 years ago was, we called it the Moneyball view, the U.S.'s true interest expense. And so if you remember Moneyball, the whole premise of the book was basically the Oakland A's were able to build a competitive team on a very shoestring budget because baseball systemically underpaid guys that walked a lot relative to guys that hit a lot of singles, even though functionally there's no difference between a single and a walk. So what we said was the U.S.'s Moneyball expense or true interest expense to arrive at that number, you can't just look at the U.S.'s interest expense as given. You have to look at interest expense plus the pay-as-you-go portions of entitlements. And once you start lumping the pay-as-you-go portions on as entitlements, because ultimately the pay-as-you-go portions are really just the interest expense on those really big entitlement numbers, you got into a much more troubling picture for U.S. fiscal situation. You got much closer to that point where the U.S. government was going to have to, or the Fed was going to have to print the money just to pay the interest on the U.S.'s true interest expense. And so I give all of that by way of background because as a result, basically our point was 2 years ago is in the next crisis, the U.S. fiscal situation is going to get irrecoverable and the Fed will basically always have to be involved from that point forward in some way, shape, or form. Fast forward to the COVID crisis, and in June of this year, if you look at interest expense, net interest expense, not even gross, net interest expense plus the pay-as-you-go portion of entitlements, which are entitlements, healthcare, and veterans benefits, what you got was that the United States was spending 106% of tax receipts on true interest expense, on those items. And that's the point where you have to print 6% of tax receipts just to pay the interest on the cost. Now, in July, we had a bolus of receipts, tax receipts, because of the shift of tax payments from April to July in the U.S. And so that number ticked back under 100%. It'll be interesting to see what happens when the August numbers come out and going on. And again, this is a fluid number because it depends on some of those factors I talked about before. What's nominal GDP growth do? What's productivity do? What's the dollar do? What's global growth do? But the point is that COVID blew a gigantic hole in the U.S. budget, and we're now at that over 100% of tax receipts, true interest expense being over 100% of tax receipts. And this is a problem that is around the world having a similar type of problem. And so again, when I when you tie back to the, well, we need some sort of big event, we had the event. At least on one level here, you needed an event to push sovereign debt as a percent of tax receipts into these irrecoverable situations to provide the political cover. Because to your point, Eric, there's no pushback from anybody on either side of the aisle anymore. Just spend the money, right? So I think we've reached a point. I think COVID pushed us into a point of no return. And when I say point of no return, again, it's what's normal for the spider is chaos for the fly. If I'm long a bunch of U.S. 10 years at 65 basis points, and we start doing what I think we're going to do, which is what Stan Fisher wanted us to do and which Stephanie Kelton thinks we should do. And yeah, I'm feeling a bit more like the fly than the spider. If I own a lot of gold and a lot of the right types of equities, you know, long duration equities, we've seen obviously with the NASDAQ, yeah, I'm feeling more like a spider than a fly. So again, it's what I'm trying to do is just help clients be spiders, not flies, because we can't change the situation. The COVID crisis blew a hole in it, and it's, you know, we're sort of into the flat spin, to mix my metaphors. You know, it very well may be irrecoverable.
Luke, I want to pull this into big picture perspective. What you're telling me here is we're into that kind of point of no return with the U.S. fiscal situation, and it's clear enough that smart finance guys like you can see it clear as day. We know we got really serious problems here. Meanwhile, we're having a global pandemic that is crippling global GDP. It's a really big problem. Meanwhile, as you've said, U.S. cities are not figuratively, but literally burning as we speak. There are riots in the streets. Things are really, really bad right now. And the S&P 500 rallied to new all-time highs on the news. Luke, please explain.
I remember Mark Faber one time saying, when things get really bad, the price of everything goes up. And that comment has always stuck with me. And I think that was, I think it was Mark Faber. But I think ultimately, I think there's a lot of people, a lot more people than a lot of investors think, looking at the world through the lens that I just described, which is COVID made the situation irrecoverable. And there's one of two outcomes. The first outcome is the authorities don't do enough, and monetary authorities and fiscal authorities don't do enough. And what we see in the streets now is a modest warm up to what comes, because ultimately you see GDP decline further. The debts that are out there become in large part unpayable. You see U.S. government and global sovereign government defaults on sovereign debt, on promised entitlements. It just depends where how bad you want to paint the picture in your mind. But that's the first option. And we saw just a little glimpse of this in March when the S&P peaked, I think February 27th, 12 days later, after falling just 12 days. It fell a lot in 12 days, but it fell only 12 trading days. U.S. Treasury bond market started crashing alongside the U.S. equity market, which in my career had never happened. When the market went down big, treasuries were bid. And this time it crashed, the treasury market was crashing almost tick for tick with the equity market. And the problem was, the thing that's really different this time is the U.S.'s net international investment position, or NIIP, is negative 50 to 55% of GDP. And in plain English, what that means, when you compare that to 2008, that number was negative 8%. When you compare that to 1999, that number was negative 2%. And what that means is foreigners own on net assets, dollar assets, equivalent to negative 50% of U.S. GDP, or $11 trillion. These numbers were much smaller in the past. What it means we did is we hocked our family's silver from 2008 to present to fuel the economic recovery we've had since then. And so when you have a problem anywhere because of the setup, foreigners are going to dump dollar assets to acquire the dollars they need. And so your option one is this deflationary spiral if monetary and fiscal authorities do not do enough at any point. And March, at first, they didn't do enough. And we saw what happens. Now, the other side is they do enough. And then it's sort of the opposite side. It's a very big, it's good for gold. It's good for equities. Nominally, it's fine for bonds. Bond yields don't have to go anywhere, per se. It's good for commodities. You know, and again, depending on what the fiscal side does, it'll be inflationary. So far, it's been primarily asset inflationary. But the U.S. ran an $865 billion deficit in the month of June alone. And so if the U.S. comes out and says, listen, we're going to spend $865 billion every month until further notice, and the Fed's going to take it all down, that's going to be CPI inflationary too. We haven't seen that yet, but that's something I'd be looking for when you talk about what could be an event, a quote-unquote event. So those are two options, right? The deflationary spiral or what I just laid out. The question then is trying to handicap what's more likely. And to me, a very powerful motivator is, or understanding of handicapping this, was put out by the Dutch National Bank at the end of, I think, 2019, where they said, look, if the whole system collapses, you know, we own gold, because if the whole system collapses, gold will be used to rebuild the whole thing. And if that happens, it's not going to be with gold at 2200 or 2500 or 1800 or 1200. It's going to be with gold at like 22,000. So policymakers probably don't want to see that, because ultimately, if they screw this up, gold is going to be used, and they're allergic to that. And so I think they would rather err on the side of doing too much. Now, again, so far, it's just been asset inflationary. To really make it inflationary, CPI inflationary, you got to do some, the fiscal authority has to do some irresponsible things in terms of deficits. And then the central bank has to effectively monetize it. And we're not there yet.
Well, Luke, I, for one, have complete faith in our elected officials to do irresponsible things with respect to deficits. No lack of confidence on my part there in any event.
Mine either.
We cannot have a Luke Roman interview without going deeper than you just alluded to gold. We got to really go to that. But I want to start with a different perspective than we usually talk about. You know, you just mentioned $22,000 gold in passing, and I can just feel the gold bug saying, oh boy, this is great. Luke Roman says $22,000 gold. This is great. Look.
Yeah, please don't use that as the title of this interview. That's not what I want to be on record on. I do not need that cut. I'm just saying, hypothetically, if they really let this thing get out of hand, it'd be, you know, you could see that kind of a thing.
Luke, what scares me is that I agree with you emphatically. I am overweight gold myself, as well as overweight gold equities. But here's the thing. I think that if you understand macro, what you understand is that the only reason to ever expect a really big secular move up in the price of gold is if you expect a situation to eventuate where all of the smartest people who are able to understand the economic situation conclude, holy shit, I want to get my money the hell out of the financial system. I don't want to participate anymore in the efficient formation of capital to support the growth and expansion of American businesses and to make the economy a better place. I want to protect myself by getting the hell out of risk assets into something that is going to be safe, even if the currency itself experiences a significant devaluation. I'm not at all disagreeing with you that gold is the smart place for a self-serving investor to put their money. But doesn't the outlook that we both share, that's very bullish on gold prices going much higher, doesn't that necessarily portend a very, very negative outlook for what the next several years are going to bring for the global economy?
I think it depends. I think they could. Absolutely, they could. Because I think on one level, you're absolutely right. That is, I would say, one leg of a decision tree of why own gold. I think the other leg on the decision tree is sort of this dynamic of what's normal for the spider is chaos for the fly. And I go back to this system we've had since 1971. The spiders in this situation were Washington, D.C., where in 2012, the Washington Post noted that 7 of the 10 richest counties in America were around Washington, D.C., even though Washington, D.C., I think, only emits deficits on net. That's what they do. They're in the dollar export business. They're in the treasury export business. They did very well. However, for real median wages in the United States, real median family income in the United States has been largely flat since 1971. They were the flies in this situation. And so to me, it comes down to the reason why, if gold really works, is it because the whole system has chaotically collapsed? And in which case, that's pretty bad. That's ugly. And you know, you're going to want some, probably some doomer prepper type stuff to go alongside that, and all the kind of things that you hear of sort of the worst of you know, financial Armageddon. The other side of it is something we saw happen in 1971, something we saw happen in 1946, something we saw happen, and we hear it seen periodically throughout time, which is that the currency system as structured sees a major change. And so if the reason we see gold at a much higher price is because suddenly gold is being used again as the primary reserve asset to settle imbalances or to settle, you know, if basically gold takes the place of treasury bonds as the primary reserve asset, then in the global financial system, then what you're going to see is the reason for gold rising is going to be really good for the global financial system. It's just going to be that the spiders are going to be the flies and the flies are going to be the spiders to a certain degree. In other words, the Fed could be doing what Fisher said, which is directly monetizing U.S. deficits and capping interest rates, what Fisher said in that white paper. And gold could be going through the roof. U.S. wage growth could be going through the roof. And, you know, if wage growth is growing 10, 15, 20% and bond yields are 65 basis points, that's actually a really good scenario. It amounts to basically a soft default across, or a jubilee across dollar debt markets. But remember, the problem of the world that, you know, that Brett Johnson and Jeff Snyder and everyone says there's this dollar shortage. Well, this would resolve the dollar shortage in a big way. Nominal global GDP growth would explode to the upside. Bondholders would not be real happy with the outcome. But boy, if I'm a wage earner in America and my wages grow 15, 20%, my mortgage doesn't move, boy, after a few years of that, my mortgage is eminently more affordable. I probably go out to eat a little bit more. I probably spend some more money on, you know, some other consumer goods. You basically have a one-time, what amounts to a one-time significant devaluation of dollar debt globally over some span of time. And, you know, this sounds crazy on some level, but you saw exactly this happen in the countries, in Western countries after World War II, where you saw a span of years where real rates in Europe, Japan, some other places were anywhere from -15 to -40%. -15 to 40% real rates. People are freaking out in the U.S. are -1.5 right now. And so, you know, can you imagine what the price of gold would be in the United States if real rates were -10, -15, -20 for a couple years? It'd be significantly higher. But that's a situation where, again, I think it's really good for part of the economy. I think it's really bad for part of the economy. But I think in net, because the world's short dollars, you would have probably the biggest nominal global GDP boom since 1946.
Luke, final question. I want to talk about the election outcome. What would it mean for markets if, hypothetically, the result of the election is, drumroll please, we don't find out for weeks or even months, and potentially we get into a situation where January 20th Inauguration Day is rapidly approaching, and there is still a massively heated debate, and nobody is in agreement as to who the next president is? Would that drive the S&P to yet another all-time high? Or would we be in another, at least temporary COVID-like stock market down scenario? What could happen? And also, do you think that that's a realistic scenario? I'm starting to really get concerned about it.
I would defer to other more political people on how realistic it is. But to me, as a tourist, I agree. I think it's starting to become more, if it was a far tail risk, far out tail risk a few months ago, I think it is at the very least a fat tail risk, and it might be moving into sort of the realms of real possibility in a normal distribution curve. As far as what it means for markets, I'm torn, I guess, two ways, or I think about it two ways. The first way is I go back to summer of 2017. And if you remember at the time, there was I think it was a French election where there was a far right, at least as how I understood it, a more far right French politician competing for office there. And I can't remember the French president's name at the time, escaped my mind. Anyway, the point is this: it was routinely used as a reason to be short the euro, because if this far right politician gets elected in France, the euro is going to break apart, or there's more stresses, and. Fast forward to today, And we have a similar situation where it's suddenly becoming, as we just said, actually credible that you could have some sort of contested election or something. And so I guess in the short run, it makes me think, you know, why step in front of that train in terms of the dollar? It probably is not supportive of the dollar tactically, the possibility of this happening as we move into the election. And then if it happened, I think it would further be bad for the dollar. I think on the other side, if it's clean cut and nobody accuses anybody of impropriety and you know, Trump leaves office without, if he loses without event or vice versa, and there's just, it's a clean cut election, then you probably would see a big rebound in the dollar, I would think, just given a relief, a reversal of positioning, and just a reaffirmation that, okay, this America can handle a transfer of power just like they always have. And it's been one of the big attractions for capital flows here. In terms of what it means for risk assets, if the dollar goes down more, the more the dollar goes down, the more the global GDP is going to go up. We've seen that. We saw it in 2017. You know, when the dollar fell 12%, we came to 2018, and most strategists on Wall Street were talking about global coordinated growth. It wasn't global coordinated growth. It was a dollar down 12% in 2017. And we saw that as soon as the dollar stopped going down, because as soon as it started going back up, all those, you know, the global coordinated growth narrative faded away. And so in the short run, if the dollar gets weaker as a result of this, it's probably good for global growth, and it's probably good for risk assets broadly, as well as commodities and gold. Ultimately, where it gets a little trickier, and I just don't have a great answer for it, is the capital flight side. The capital's already here. Remember, we talked about that net international investment position of negative 50 to 55% of GDP. All that capital's here. And so if the dollar falls too far or gets really disorderly, then you have to start worrying about capital flight related selling of assets. And that's, I think, probably the Fed's worst case scenario, because then what do? They basically have to let the market crash, or they have to completely destroy the sanctity of markets, or destroy, maybe more apropos, destroy the remaining vestiges of the illusion of the sanctity of markets by stepping into supporting stocks, supporting credit spreads, supporting corporate bonds, et cetera, and to stem that capital flight. Because there's no, if you get a crash on capital flight because the dollar's weak, Fed's got to raise rates to stop the dollar being weak. And that's not going to help a market crash. That's not going to help an economy crash. So I don't know, but those are the framework that I'm thinking about. But I would say, gun to my head, I would say it's probably bad for the dollar between now and the election. Depending how it's handled, it's probably, if the election goes okay, it could be good for the dollar. And I think weak dollar is in the short run good for risk. It's good for global economy. But beyond some unknowable tipping point, you start running risks of capital flight out of the United States. And that could be bad for asset prices and put the Fed in a real bind. So that's how I would think and talk through it.
Luke, before I let you go, please tell our listeners what they can expect to find on your website and your Twitter handle.
Absolutely. So if you're interested in learning more about us, hearing more, I'm on Twitter at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen. And if you're interested in learning more about our various research product offerings, you can go to FFTT-LLC, Forest for the Trees-LLC, FFTT-LLC. And you can see what we're up to in terms of appearances and research product offerings there, both retail, RIA, institutional as well.
Luke, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. Patrick Serezna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Farmland investing has been a popular macro trend among billionaires and big institutions for the last decade. But the high cost of buying an entire farm put this asset class out of reach to all but big institutions and the ultra-rich. FarmTogether.com allows any accredited investor to invest in fractional ownership of several different categories of farmland. I recently did a full-length interview with FarmTogether.com founder and CEO Artem Milinchuk. We discussed the macro argument for farmland investing, performance and correlation comparisons to conventional asset classes, and the different types of farmland and their investment characteristics. If you're an accredited investor, I recommend that you listen to that interview and learn why farmland investing might be a fit for your portfolio.
You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or just type the word farmland into the search box on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Luke back on the show. I was actually thinking he was going to be a little bit more bearish toward the dollar. He seemed to be kind of still straddling the opinion a little bit. But I mean, the dollar has had a pretty big move. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, I think that Luke's perspective is spot on, which is to say, look, you can't look at this current move down and say, okay, oh my gosh, this is it. This is the Luke Grohman moment. The point Luke made, I think very eloquently, is the Luke Grohman moment is a slow motion event that's been in process for a couple of years now. And I think he makes a very good argument. The thing that I freely admit that I don't understand is I think Jeff Snyder's arguments are really excellent as well. And I was really thinking that we would see a squeeze higher in the dollar relative to other currencies. I thought that Jeff Snyder and Brent Johnson were going to be proven right first, and then eventually Luke was going to be proven right in the long run. Well, the Jeff Snyder, Brent Johnson view, although it logically still makes a lot of sense to me, sure isn't what the tape is telling us is happening. So as Brent told us last week, you know, if we don't see a reversal pretty soon here, it's time to just say, hey, it's not working the way we thought. And does that mean that Luke's view is being proven right? Well, of course, according to Luke, it's been right all along. It's just happening slowly, and it's happening progressively. In any event, what is not happening slowly or progressively is the reversal candle that we saw today on the S&P 500. Let's dive into the post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't registered yet for your free account at macrovoices.com. Shame on you. You can get one by looking for the red button on our homepage at macrovoices.com, just above Luke's picture that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, let's dive into slide two. Boy, look at that big, bright red reversal candle. And of course, that's today's tape action. What does this tell you as the technician in the house?
Well, you know what? The big question I wanted to simply ask, one day never makes a new trend. And there's no way that, I mean, those people that are looking for the big crash in itself, it always starts with a big down day, but it doesn't always have to end in it being a crash. And so what I was really illustrating here was the fact that when you look back to February, when that crash candle started the sequence that began the COVID crash, it spent basically 2 days downwards and then never was able to recover. But if you look at what corrections we've had in the market since, and I only circled one of them, but you can see it at least on four or five different spots since the bottom, where the markets had what are these typical 2 to 3 day market corrections. And they often will give back a chunk of the prior rise. They'll pause and they get bought on dip. So I think the biggest puzzle piece for us to solve in the next week is, does this create a new feedback mechanism that creates some big new market event to the downside? Or is this just going to end up being a buy on dip? And while I certainly feel that there are a lot of risks in the markets, and certainly we're starting from a very elevated level, which in itself can heighten the chance of this being deeper than expected, I think the jury's still out as to what we're about to see. And I think that maybe by Monday or Tuesday next week, seeing how the market behaves after the selling is, you know, that's kind of 24 to 48 hours of selling is dissipated, how the market reacts is going to be a real big tell.
Well, Patrick, I agree with that. And I'd also point out that if you just look at long-term seasonality in the stock market, right around Labor Day is oftentimes a turning point or an acceleration point. So the notion that, what are we, 2 trading sessions before the Labor Day holiday, the fact that that might be the time when things either start to reverse or make a head fake before actually accelerating in the prior direction. It all fits in. It's you know, very consistent with what you tend to see this time of year. And I think I'm willing to wager that September will be a very interesting month. I'd say now through the election is going to be a very interesting time in markets. Is that an interesting downside time or an upside time? Well, I guess we'll wait and see. Let's move on now to page three. You've got the FANG Plus Index. That's the expanded darling tech stock index. Boy, sure looks like the beginning of a blow-off top, but I guess it's too early to call it. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to make the observation of just simply seeing the magnitude of this rise that we've witnessed since the March bottom versus even just the 2019 into early 2020 rise. This has just been an unprecedented rise in those tech names. And, you know, Eric, I'll ask you, like, is a 30 to 40% market correction a big deal? Because in my mind, that's what we saw in the S&P 500 just back during the COVID drop. And what's amazing about this rise is that if the FANG stocks index just had a 30 to 40% decline, it would just be approaching its pre-COVID highs. It's just amazing to put into context of just how far the FANGs have shot to the upside and how much room there is for mean reversion, even if it's not breaking the bigger picture uptrend that's now been very clearly established. One of the big leaders in that big parabolic rise, and I want to talk about this in greater detail, and particularly some of the fuel that's been driving it, is on page four, the Tesla chart. And similarly to the statement I was making, I mean, I'm not trying to forecast Tesla going down there, but if Tesla right now experienced a 60% decline, it would just be reaching the highs it put in prior to the COVID correction. And it's just amazing how far these stocks have shot higher. And so it asked the question, you know, was this the Fed, right? Every person I hear saying is like, you know what, the Fed liquidity surge came in driving the stocks. You can't fight this. These stocks are going to keep going up. And while I, in principle, don't deny or wouldn't even push back on the notion that that massive liquidity surge that the Fed put into the markets was, in fact, very real and driving the stock markets, and at least drove stability in the stock markets. The one thing that I feel that people are very quick to, or not discounting properly, is that while the Fed provided a certain amount of liquidity, it's the speculators that have driven this move. And particularly, there are different accelerants within this market that have driven the rise in these tech stocks. So going to page five, we were talking last week about that chart that basically showed that now 75% of all options volume is now at 30 days or less, and often 2 weeks or less till expiration, which basically means that all of these options, and particularly the growth in call option volume, has now created huge gamma pull on the front of the markets. And this has been even further accelerated in the last week or two. On page six, I have a couple of quotes that were out there, one from Citadel, one that says that over the past few weeks, there has been a massive buyer in the market of technology upside calls and call spreads across a basket of names, including Adobe, Amazon, Facebook, Salesforce, Microsoft, Google, and Netflix. Over $1 billion of premium was spent and an upwards of $20 billion of notional through strike. This is arguably some of the largest single stock flow we have seen in years. The average daily options contract traded on the NASDAQ stocks to rise from $4 million a day average in April to $5.5 million a day on average in August, a 38% jump in volume. So that's from Citadel. The point that they're making is that some monstrous institutional buyers are coming in with real money. This isn't Robin Hooders that are coming in driving this call buying volume. And this is creating a huge gamma pull on the upside of the market, acting like a fuel or accelerant to the upside of the market. It's sort of like hitting nitro in a car that's already going 100 miles an hour. But the one thing is that a lot of people are trying to say or suggest that this is now the new speed of the market. And well, the one thing that I look at this, when you're talking about such short-term gamma driven by these options, at some point, that accelerant runs out, and the rate of change of the vehicle is, would slow down. In the same way, there's going to be some counter reaction to this. And while I don't want to already be joining the camp that there's some new bear market that will take the market's all-time new lows, I think we are long overdue for a proper and deep market correction that reverts and backfills this big extraordinary move that we've had.
Patrick, I just want to add a comment to what you're saying. You know, a lot of people would probably hear you and say, you know, what are you talking about Tesla having a 60% decline? That's crazy. That's, you know, that's one in a million years kind of downside event. Look, for any stock to return back to the price it was at the beginning of the current year is not a once-in-a-lifetime event. It's a perfectly typical, normal thing to have happen. So, yeah, it would be a huge percentage. I think it would take about a 75% downside correction or bear market in Tesla just to get back to its January 1st opening price for this year. And, you know, what goes up must come down eventually. This is a stock that, if you value it based on the viability of its business plan, has never been worth more than $4 a share. Forget about $450 a share. So, you know, there's a lot of fluff and excess in this market. Does it mean it's going to come out, or is it just going to be fueled even higher by even more liquidity in the marketplace? Well, I guess we'll find out.
You know, the one thing that I will put a thought out there, there's a new truism that is passed around today in the markets, which is that don't fight the Fed. The Fed will always provide the liquidity, and therefore the stock market can only go up because they're not going to let it go down. So you can accept that truism to be true, but there's another truism that conflicts with that in the market, which is that there's a long, rich history of the stock market separating fools from their money. And what you have to ask yourself is, which truism do you believe to be more true, because only one of them is going to be right.
Well, Patrick, I don't want to be on the hook for answering which one's going to be right. So let's move on to something I actually know about, which is crude oil on page 7. As you can see here, although the last couple of days were pretty vicious, boy, isn't that, I mean, you're the technician here, but doesn't today look like it could be the beginning of an upside reversal candle? It wasn't a perfect doji, but it was pretty darn close. And normally I would say, hey, look, this market is just way overdue to roll over to the downside. We need a sizable correction. We're overdue for one. It's got to be the beginning of much more downside. But look at all of the times since June or so where I thought that was starting, and it turned out to be just a false breakdown. And after a couple days, it turned out that buying the dip was the right thing to do. Is this another one? Or maybe we're past the seasonality of summer driving season, and it really is time to have that correction down to, say, $35 or so, that frankly has been overdue for quite a while. I'm not sure yet. I think the next couple days, next couple market sessions are going to be very telling. How do you see this chart?
Well, you know, I don't want to look just at the crude oil chart alone. What one has to do is put it into the context of the broader intermarkets, because what if, and so let's just do a what if exercise. Well, what if the stock market just began a risk off period where this period between now and the elections, the stock market has a lot of challenging periods and a lot of volatility. Let's not go much more beyond that. But during that period, we see money flow into risk off assets. We see yields dropping as money flows into the 10-year treasury bond. We see potentially a short-term low and a mean reversion in the dollar. If we start seeing that kind of an intermarket environment, I think that oil may still have more to drop. I do believe the major lows in oil are in. I don't know if we'd ever see negative oil prices ever again, but I do feel that if we go into a risk-off period, that could be something that drives oil to pull back into the mid to low 30s, but that would mean that those other markets would have to be doing that. If those things aren't happening, then oil could very easily bounce right back and just stay within this range, and this could be a fake out. But we'll see. The one thing I wanted to talk to you though about on page 8 is the crude oil term structure. And often we see some bumps in there that create some form of backwardation, but this is a very clear contango in the entire oil curve. What do you make of all of that?
Well, I'll also point out it's not shown on this particular chart, but if you see that bend in the term structure, which is right around June of 2021, about 9 months out on the curve, you see the angle of the line changes pretty abruptly there. That wasn't there. Well, it was there a little bit, but it wasn't nearly as pronounced a week ago. So as we're seeing the market start to sell off, what the market's telling us is, okay, contango is steepening about out to June of 2021. And then the term structure from there kind of follows a much more steady trajectory all the way out to the end of the curve. So I think that what that's telling us is the market's trying to figure out, okay, it's probably going to be that the market is rebalanced by June of 21. That's 9 months from now. But what happens from here? Are we about to see a bunch of more downside down to the low 30s or even below? And I think you could make an argument for as low as $26 a barrel from here. I don't think it would last very long, but that's plausible. I think in the low to mid 30s is probably a more likely downside target if this becomes substantial. Already, the term structure is starting to signal that possibility at the front end of the curve, but you're noticing the back end of the curve isn't budging because it so far is discounting this, saying it's just short term for now. The front of the curve is moving on it. The back of the curve isn't. It's important to watch whether or not that this line continues to hinge at that same point. And if we do go down a little more, does the front of the curve steepen its contango and the back stays the same? Or does the back start to come off too, which would suggest that the market thinks this could be longer lasting than just a short-term correction? So it'll be very interesting to see what happens as this situation develops over the next few weeks.
All right, well, let's move on to page 9, because I wanted to talk natural gas. We're always talking oil, and I wanted to just take a look at this natural gas chart. And what we've seen throughout the majority of the summer of 2020 is a pretty clear bottoming formation establishing itself. And what many technicians are observing is a legitimate and proper bull breakout of natural gas prices, and they've sort of been marching to the beat of their own drum. But what's particularly interesting, and we'll talk about it in the term structure in a moment, is that we're going into the seasonal period where natural gas prices are actually rising. So, Eric, let's have a quick look at that natural gas term structure.
Well, Patrick, this crazy pattern you see, this sawtooth pattern in the natural gas term structure, is actually to be expected. It always looks that way. The reason for that is because natural gas has a much, much higher storage cost than oil does. You can't just throw it in a salt cavern or a simple unpressurized metal tank and let it sit there for 5 years the way you can with crude oil. Once natural gas has been produced, meaning that it's been taken out of the natural well or reservoir that it has been sitting in for millions of years, in order to store it, it's much more expensive because you have to worry about temperature and pressure and specialized tanks and liquefaction and refrigeration and so forth. So what happens is, because there is a seasonal use pattern and a seasonal demand pattern, the price and the expected price in the future tends to just be up and down like a sawtooth. And so this is entirely about annual seasonality. Each one of these big sawtooth patterns that you're seeing here is 1 year's worth of seasonality in the chart. And it always looks like this. What that tells you, though, is that if you're buying natural gas just because you were looking at a chart like the one on page 9, you're saying, hey, it looks like it bottomed there in July, and it looks like it's headed up. Maybe it's going to continue heading up. Well, this chart on page 9 is kind of misleading, because if you're buying an ETF, they have to trade the actual futures contracts, which are shown on page 10, the little yellow dots. And sure enough, there's just a super steep contango right now. So that means each time they roll their contract forward, they're rolling forward, let's say, from 250 now in the immediate delivery month to about 293 in the next month, and then 330 the month after that. It doesn't mean you're making that profit. It means you're losing ground. The new entry price is that much higher, and you didn't make any profit for reinstating your trade at that next higher price. So what happens is there's a really big tracking error between what appears to be happening on the price chart on page 9 and what the actual performance of an ETF or another instrument that invests in rolling natural gas futures. Now, unlike USO, which is the crude oil ETF that completely changed its composition to focus on a number of different contracts across the term structure, for the most part, the ETFs still roll that front month futures contract. So you're going to be subject to really big tracking errors, and it's important to really, really understand how those products work before you try to speculate on the price of natural gas based on a chart like the one on page 9.
You know, Eric, I couldn't agree with you more. The one thing the UNG does still only roll, it's a front month contracts. And so there is going to be a big tax on that roll. And it's going to be tracking quite poorly against natural gas in the next few months as we see these continuous contracts heading all the way to 340 on the upside in the next few months. What is interesting, though, is the considerably higher prices this year for natural gas versus the long term, because during this kind of 2021 to 2026 period, they're still forecasting and pricing in $2.40 to $2.80 natural gas prices. And yet here at the front of the curve, we are going towards $3.40 here into the tail end of the year. Do you have any ideas on what that is? My speculation is that obviously with all the well shutdowns in the fracking space, that is creating some short-term supply issues that many traders don't believe will be there in a few years. Do you think that that could be the catalyst behind that, or do you have any other speculations for it?
Yeah, in general, storage of natural gas is much, much more complex and involved than storage of oil. And for that reason, a lot of natural gas gets flared off. That's if you've ever seen a picture of an oil field and you see that thing that looks like a big blowtorch pointing up at the sky. What they're doing is they're burning off the perfectly good natural gas that's being produced because it's actually more economic just to burn it, throw it away, and waste it than it is to capture it and have to deal with the complexities of storing it. You know, oftentimes, these oil fields are out in remote locations. You know, you don't have all kinds of equipment and electricity and so forth to be refrigerating liquefied natural gas. So it probably has to do with both the pandemic situation further encumbering the complexity of logistics and the fact that natural gas storage is inherently cumbersome and expensive to start with. As far as the particulars of exactly what's going on right now in this natural gas market today, I'm not a natty guy. You know, you've got to really be one of the traders who focuses on and specializes in nat gas in order to really understand that, and it's outside my field of expertise.
Well, if any of our listeners have some insights on that, please feel free to share it with us. We'd love to know. Nonetheless, I want to move on to page 11, where I have the chart of the euro. And one of the things I referenced earlier when we're talking crude oil is just what are we about to witness on a broader intermarket basis? And what's interesting to me is that while we have had a pronounced US dollar decline, which is to the opposite, a very strong euro, what we've seen in the last month is a number of times that the euro has tried to break to a higher high and rally, and each time it failed to hold the breakout and has reverted back. While it's very premature to already be trying to suggest that this is somehow a huge topping formation, there's no denying that many topping formations start by looking like this. And I think one of the bigger things to watch here in the coming days and weeks is whether or not at least short to intermediate move in the dollar has played out. You know, I mean, we obviously a lot of our guests come on and talk the big picture, what's really in store for the next year or two. But I think that this is going to be a really important moment to find out what happens here on the next, you know, 1 to 3 month swing. And especially if the stock market feels very heavy, it'd be interesting to see if we have a dollar up a kind of risk off impulse here in the currency.
Patrick, let's move on to page 12. Boy, an abrupt reversal in Bitcoin as well as other assets this week. What's your interpretation of this?
Well, you know what? There'll be a lot of technicians that are going to be trying to call that a head and shoulders. There was an attempt just a few days ago for that flagging formation to bullishly break out, which should have arguably given the tailwind and impulse for Bitcoin to head toward 14,000 on the upside. And instead, not only does it reverse, but it reverses right at a key overhead resistance and subsequently breaks the consolidation on the downside. And so it's really interesting to find out whether or not this has solidified at least a short to intermediate top. I don't want to try and make the big call on that. But what's your take on it?
Well, I would liken this to dot-com stocks in the late 1990s. And I think it has to do with the sophistication of the market versus the complexity of the underlying asset. The market was right in the late 90s to think, hey, the internet's going to be a really big deal. This is a place to invest. They got that right. The way it got interpreted was a whole bunch of people who had no clue about any of the technology involved just started buying anything that has .com in its name without thinking about it. And that, of course, resulted in the .com bust in 2000. I think what you're seeing now is it's very, very clear that the digital currency revolution is going to be a defining aspect of the next 25 years of human history. There's no doubt about that in my mind. Right now, most people think, just like the sophistication of the stock market in 1999 was, well, we're not really sure what all this internet shit actually is, so let's just buy anything with a .com in it. Bitcoin is clearly the most pervasive and popular cryptocurrency, so it must be a good thing to buy, right? I guess so, whatever. Frankly, I don't think people really understand the digital currency revolution that's coming or what it's about. We've got a lot of requests for why don't we talk more about it on Macro Voices. Well, frankly, Macro Voices is about macroeconomics. It's not really in scope for us. I am doing a full-length interview. I think it's going to be a really good one with a guy named Jan Pritzker, who wrote a book about Bitcoin. Jan and I agree on a lot of things, disagree on others. That's going to be next Wednesday, September 9th. And it's on the Swan Bitcoin YouTube channel. And as I understand it, it's going to be actually airing live. So if you want to tune into that, I'll have lots and lots to say about digital currency, about Bitcoin, about the reasons that I don't think the market is correctly interpreting what's going on at this stage of the digital currency revolution. But it really doesn't fit into what we do here on Macro Voices. So that's why we're not covering it on this particular show.
Listeners, if you want to tune in to listen to Eric, do that. We'll include the link in the Research Roundup email. So, Eric, let's move on to chart 13, page 13 of the chart on the 10-year treasury yield. And I just really wanted to point out something we talked about in the market wrap earlier, which was it really looked like those yields were trying to break out last week. And there was a lot of people that were talking about the fact that the Fed was going to let the inflation run hot, and it was starting to kind of spook everyone on the 10-year treasury yield. And then suddenly in the last 5 days, it's just been straight down from there. And we're down right now about those 62 basis points. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not bonds confirm a sort of a risk off. I still think that they're the canary in the coal mines. And if we see yields breaking down to 50 basis points or lower, I don't know how the stock market is going to like that. So, I mean, this is something that it's at least something I'm going to be watching very closely next week.
Patrick, before we wrap up for this week, I want to just mention to our listeners, we didn't have time to go into detail on the calendared straddle strategy, which Patrick has been working with his Big Picture Trading members. For Big Picture Trading folks, you guys, my hat's off to you. You've been raking in the dough with that strategy because you rolled your straddles up right at the top of the market, and I know that's been very profitable. For anyone who is interested in that, we don't have time in today's show to really dive into it, but if you move on to page 14, you can get a free trial to Big Picture Trading, where you can find all about that. Patrick does 4 webinars every single week, and recently they've been focusing on that calendar strategy and how to roll it up and really maximize profits in what Patrick very accurately called as at least a short-term market top. The information on that is on page 14, or you can just go to bigpicturetrading.com and sign up for a free 14-day trial. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com, making farmland investing a $1 trillion asset class available to all accredited investors, and by TopTradersUnplugged.com,
Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplug.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to that Stanley Fisher BlackRock article Luke referenced during the interview, as well as a link to a David Rosenberg article that no matter how you slice it, markets are in a bubble of historic proportions. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.